The Boeing 757 was first planned in the mid-1970s as a successor to the moderately successful 727 Trijet. I assumed that was supposed to say Trijet, but nobody knows how to bloody type anymore. A jet that we have already discussed ad nauseum 30 episodes ago. Try to keep up, you slackers. This type of unholy union happens when a mummy fuselage and a daddy fuselage share a special hug. The 757 was conceived in that unholy union. Originally named the 7N7, nobody could decide if the N was making a reference to an algebraic integer, please note that math is a four-letter word, or if somebody at Boeing was pretending to be cute by making references to TNT, which is an explosive, and probably as intelligent as saying the word bomb in a TSA checkpoint. If you'd like to discover what a cavity search is without having to see a dentist, do exactly that. From its conception in 1975, before any of you were born, to maiden flight in February 1982, also before any of you were born, and entering service in December of 1982, you're all infants, aren't you? It took more years than expected to finally get the thing launched. Pun intended. A package freighter variant entered service in September of 1987. You may now all giggle at all the package jokes you can think of. I'll wait. The stretched version of the 757-300 was launched in September of 1996 and began service in March of 1999. Contrary to popular belief, it wasn't made of rubber. After 1,050 units had been built for 54 customers, production ended in October of 2004. A run of almost 30 years for a production isn't that awful. I challenge any of you to do anything for that many years that isn't breathing, defecating, or crying to your mothers. It is a sad footnote, however, that two of these jets were among the hijacked flights on September 11th of 2001. There's nothing funny about that. If you are interested in seeing the 64th model of this flight built, you may do so at the Delta Flight Museum in Atlanta, Georgia. If for no other reason, then it is the 64th unit constructed of that line, and you're all fanatics of the Nintendo 64 as the superior game console, you may as well get after it. Pitter-patter and all that. Send Joe Cam a selfie. For those of you keeping track at home, dear God, get a life. Go outside. Fly in a jet for the love of everything.
Hello? I'm going to answer every time like that now.
Do I have to keep this now?
Yes.
I don't know. What happened? Something happened. What happened?
Brooke said hello like an old lady who doesn't understand why you're calling her.
Why are you calling me?
Thank you. That's a really good Brooke impression.
Where are you?
Shugging?
What year is it?
What year is it?
I love that you had that joke loaded up and ready to go for an entire week.
Y'all really loaded it up. I just remembered.
Yeah.
Oh, good thing I record everything. What's up, everyone? This is the SML Podcast. I'm your host, Joe. As you can tell, it's a party cast. We got Brooke here, we got Chris here, and we got Purnell here. How is everyone doing?
I'm not going to lie. I'm sad that Tim is not here. I'm very sad.
He'll be back next week. He's got a game to talk about next week.
Ooh. Hope it's a big one.
It is.
Oh,
so
snap.
Big, I can't talk about it.
Is it big as Al Bundy?
Al Bundy, yes.
Oh, man. At the nudie bar. Oh, I missed that show.
No, nudie bar is in GTA 5. Did you see the pricing for GTA 5 on the new consoles?
Who was it?
$40.
What?
Like, they're still charging $40 for this fucking thing. Like, give us free upgrades if we own it digital already.
Well, I mean, you know why they're doing it? Because it's going to sell. Like, it's sad, but it's going to sell, and they know it. So they're going to get their money where they can get it. Part of that bridge. But, like, for me, I'm done. I bought it on the 360 originally. Then I got the PS4 version of it. And that's enough. Like it's gone through three generations. It's done. Go away.
We used to get three GTAs a generation, and now we got one GTA through three generations.
Which is kind of odd. I guess it's not odd. That's because they hit that online and it worked. So it's like, why bother?
Yeah, they're getting their money. That's half the price right there. Because
I don't understand the appeal of it. Like, I mean, it may have changed over the years because I didn't play it since it originally came out. But back then, it was like, okay, you can commit crimes to earn money to buy cars and properties. But the cars and properties didn't do anything. They were just kind of status symbols, and it wasn't hard to amass the money to get the best stuff. So,
I mean, cars and property in real life are just status symbols. How are you going to drive more than one car?
True, but let's be honest. If I was making GTA money in real life and I was going to buy a car, I want to get one of those cars I can take out to Arizona and go freak nasty with it. Just burn the highway up, potentially get into a wreck, but I'll be in the desert so no one will care. If I got the money to get a vehicle that allowed me to fly and I got my pilot's license, I'm going to actually fly the thing. I'll feel like I'm flying a plane, which is the experience in and of itself. But in GTA, it's just like, I got this really fast car to virtually drive around virtual Los Angeles or wherever the fuck game takes place. And it's like, what's the point?
Is that any different than buying like the coolest sword in a game and being like, look at me, I got the coolest sword in the game.
It's different. A sword has attack power, stats. You can be like, I got the coolest sword and now I'm killing enemies in one hit.
Sword skins are just skins. It doesn't matter what the hell the weapon is. You could just put any skin on it.
Oh, you're talking about skins. I'm talking about like the actual best weapon in the game, like a weapon that has different stats.
I mean, cars have different stats. Some of them are slow. Some are fast. Some are shitty. Some handle well.
He's right.
Purnell's being the old man this week. I don't understand these goddamn GTA games.
This week on a very special episode of the SML podcast, Purnell learns that video games aren't as fun as real life reckless endangerment.
Dude, shit. I have never played a GTA game. I really haven't, but I do know, but I know that it stands for Grand Theft Auto. So this is a really stupid question, but my question as I hear all this is, why are we buying the cars in the game? Why aren't we just stealing them?
Legitimate criminal for some reason. It makes no fucking sense. It really doesn't. I mean, I guess buying the property does, because you can't steal a house. Well, I mean, unless you had that whole drug commercial, you can't download a house.
Bitch, if I could, I would.
Tell that to my character in Elder Scrolls Online.
You wouldn't download a house in GTA. You can get a mod, but I don't know. Like, I get what you're saying. Like, I see buying a house in the game, but just steal the cars. But I guess the idea is that if you buy the car, it stays in your garage. You can just drive it whenever you want instead of having to run downtown and find a sucker to rent.
No, okay. Carl in chat is saying some cars have wedges that can flip other cars. Shout out to Carl for subbing earlier before we went live. Thank you, Carl. Hugs to you.
I understand what we're talking about with this GTA stuff, because I'm like, wedges, flipping cars. You're like, yeah, GTA.
So what I think would be fun is, because it's GTA and you can purchase a car, isn't that ripe for like being able to be a victim of Grand Theft Auto? Mm-hmm. I really wish that somebody else could steal your car.
I think they can. It's a whole online world.
Oh, it is? Okay. All right. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's what GTA Online is, the online portion of the game. I know it sounds like it's online, but it's really online.
Gotcha.
I have a conspiracy theory I want to share before we get too far into the show. Are you guys ready?
Yes.
Yes.
I think that Tim wanted to come to the show and Joe wouldn't let him because then he knew me, Purnell, and Tim would just talk about Elden Ring the whole time and piss everybody off.
Oh, that's
and
a good
I am
point.
So sad because last night I just tweeted about this, but I lost over 4,000 experience because my horse turned invisible and killed me, just like what happened to Tim the other day. And I was going to be like, dude.
Wait, was it a glitch or something?
Yeah, last week, Tim, I think it's like the only time I've really seen Tim tweet. He was like, I don't remember exactly what he said, but he was like, man, when I wrote that song about how I couldn't live without my horse or something like that, he's like, I didn't think it would be this. And basically you get on your horse and it's invisible. And then you just kind of flail around for a bit, and then it says you died.
Damn.
Wow.
That was a place you couldn't get your stuff back?
Yeah, because I was trying to get my stuff back, and then I got on the horse because I took so much damage. I was like, I'm going to run away on my horse now, and then the horse killed me. And I was like, okay, first of all, I didn't just kill a 4,000 rune enemy, so, like, I should have turned my shit in before then.
Horse was like, fuck you, Will.
Yeah. And, like, I saw that happen to Tim last week, so, honestly, I probably should have kept that in mind and then not tried to flee the battle with the horse. I could have just started running, then get on it. But, yeah, long story short, I'm having such a good time at Elden Ring. I'm freaking out. No, I'm not good at it. I am, like, level 10.
You're claiming they're fucking lying. No one's good at that game.
I thought I was good at games, dude. I was wrong. I'm still in that camp. What's that first camp? With all the soldiers.
Oh, the camp on them. Yeah, I don't remember the name of it, but I know what you're talking about, where you go down, you come out of the woods, and they're kind of like in that encampment.
Yeah, I'm still there. I'm still in there, man. I know this game's hard. I started this game with my partner, and we both started up on our PS4s on the couch, and then I started training, and I was like, you can't watch me play this, dude. You need to go over somewhere else. We're starting out, and then he's played Souls games before. This is my very first one. So he immediately shoots past me and starts fighting a monster so terrifying. I'm like, dude, I'm going to drill. I'm going to farm these soldiers for a while until I feel like I can take them out in different ways.
Don't farm. Like, I know people do that. I know the internet's all like, here's the best place to get like 50,000 souls in an hour. Fuck that. No. You just run around and do shit. You get goofy and you die a lot. Like, that's literally the game. Like, I've been playing for like 12 hours.
If you don't want to die, though, and you want to grind and get stronger,
that's
an option.
No, play the game my way, damn it. I'm saying it in a sense where it's like, to me, like, and I had this chat with someone else the other day, we're talking about like, what they hate about grinding and stuff and whatnot. The game, like, I feel like by just going around and doing normal shit, like, you'll get experience that will kind of stagger up with you throughout the game. Like, for example, there's that Margit guy, which you haven't gotten to yet, but he's on the route you're traveling. And he's Margaret. like the game's wall. Like, everyone gets to him, and everybody gets wrecked by him. And then it depends on who the player is, but different people have different, you know, takes on that. Some people go, this game is too hard, I fucking quit, I can't beat this boss, which is their prerogative, but I'm like, oh, come the fuck on. The second block is, I'm going to stand outside, and I'm going to grind 40 levels and then come back. And it's like, again, it's your prerogative, but my God, like, you're using a lot of time to do this one thing for this one element. And then there's people like me who are like, well, fuck my day up, I'm leaving. Because unlike the other Souls games, it's an open world. Like, if one boss is giving you crap, just go away and come back later. Like, you don't have to mash your head to get past the guy.
I think, too.
What were you saying?
Well, I think, too, I've got, like, a bad habit of, like, when I enter, like, a really huge open world game, I already don't want it to end. I usually put at least 200 hours into a really pretty open world game like this. So I think this is also a bad habit of me, like, settling in and trying to draw the experience out. And, like, if this world is as big as Tim's been saying, I don't need to do that, man.
Spoilers. It's going to take 200 hours. Because I'm going to tell you right now. I'm, like, 12 hours in, so I'm not playing nearly as fast as any other human on Earth. And, I'm like level 12 or 14. No, that's correct. I'm level 19 now.
Nice.
I've come across a lot of cool shit. Still haven't found a sorcery vendor because the hell of that somehow. But I'm having a great time. I've explored a lot of the map, which is barely anything on the map, mind you. I'm using a flail now. Flails are cool. I'm sneaking up on dudes and stabbing them in the neck like a wizard does. It's just been a good time. And at no point have I felt like I need to grind in order to get somewhere else. Like in old Souls games, yes. because they had any, you were always on a generally linear path. Like, you might have one or two roads you can take, but they all lead to some dude that's going to wreck your face unless you're either really good at the game or you just jack your vigor, your hit point stat up. In this game, they did away with the need to do that, so don't punish yourself with it when there's this whole world to explore and you're running in circles fighting the same five soldiers. Like, don't do that to yourself. Play the game.
Or crazy thing.
I'm going to venture out.
Crazy thing. Here's some weird advice. Play a game how you want.
I get that. Here's the logic behind that, Joe. I can suggest something to her and she can go, I appreciate it, but I think grinding is the way to go for me. Or she could go, you know, that's a good idea. I'm going to explore the fucking game and come back later.
And then if she said, no, I think I'm going to grind, you'll be like, no, you're not allowed to grind.
But it might have been probably saying that because I want to get him to yell because it's funny. So.
That is true.
I'll have that going for me. Good to know I have options. Like, seriously, I'm glad to know that now because everybody's psyching me out with telling me how hard the game's going to be before I play it, telling me I'm not going to be able to beat anything before I even try it. I know these games are hard, but like, I've been scared to try it before last weekend.
I haven't even played it yet.
I think the statement of it's hard from a friend anyway, as opposed to the internet, is less about actually saying, don't play this game, it's going to fuck your face up. And more just to let you know, this is what you're coming into, because I had more than a fair share of friends who would buy this game because internet hype is talking up, despite the fact that the internet tells you it's a challenging game.
Yeah.
They'll buy the game, take it home, get to Margit, die three times, and go, this game is stupid. I don't like it. I can't just win it. I don't like it. I wasted an hour trying. I want to take it back. And people might be hearing that and going, you're exaggerating or you're just being a jerk. Like, no, I know people who legitimately do that. And don't get me wrong. Like Joe said, you know, you should enjoy the games you want to enjoy. No one's forcing you to play anything any old way. But the knowledge is out there to tell a person this game is not easy. It's doable, but you're going to work for it. And some people they'll see a big number. They'll jump on it, get their ass handed to them, and then act like there weren't any breadcrumbs telling them this is not the game for you. Well, yeah. Like, I had one friend, Joe, like our friend Joe, he was like, what do you think of the game? Like, he wanted this whole description. I'm like, I'm not going to spend the time. I already know you're not going to like the game. So, no, if you don't like Dark Souls, you're not going to like this game. Go play something different. And another friend of mine was like, I want to play it, but it's hard. Convince me to play. I was like, I'm not going to do that. Don't play it. Go play something else. Go play a different game. I'm not here for that shit.
That's why I'm playing Grid Legends, because I don't want to suffer through Elden Ring. Like, I eventually want to play it when I have the time and the patience to deal with a Souls-like. But for now, like, I don't have much time to fuck around with games, so I just want to play a quick race quick race there. I'll get to Elden Ring eventually, maybe, I hope. I mean, I bought it, so I want to play it.
There's hundreds of games. You might get to the end of this year and like 10 to 15 other smacktacular games are going to come out, and Elden Ring for you will be like, Elden who? I got enough games to play with the time I got. I don't know.
They're all going
to
be Radalakas.
It could be. I don't know.
I was going to buy Elden Ring this weekend, but my Elden Ring budget went to buying an NES game that somebody made in 2020.
I saw that.
Is it good? Like, is it a hot title, or is it just retro?
It's pretty good. It's called Doodle World. This guy in San Antonio made it, and his 7-year-old daughter was like the designer and art director for the game.
Oh man, I'm about to go make it's a perverse joke, but then you mentioned the kid. I can't even make the joke anymore.
Yeah. It's very good, and it's a solid little platformer. I'm gonna stream it at some point, but yeah, that was my Elden Ring budget. So I was like, well, I gotta wait another week then.
Is it just me, or is there like something really cool lately about coming across these games, video or board, where you learn that the game was co-developed with the designer's kid? Like, it's just something wholesome about that. It makes you want to buy it.
It's always cool.
Like,
and then Chris, I think I convinced you to buy something else. I didn't convince you to. I just gave you the outlet to buy something.
This exists.
I just pointed it at you, and you were like, yes, must have.
I wasn't quite like that. I was just like, well, I'm buying this. It's from a company called At Games, and it's a arcade stick, like a full-size arcade stick, but it's preloaded with 100 games. And like they appear to be like licensed games from kind of all over, like arcade and Genesis and Super Nintendo. Although Super Nintendo is, they do not say Nintendo anywhere on it. It's just like 16-bit game.
But they have like Disney stuff on there, like Lion King and Aladdin and Tetris is on there.
Yeah, so I'm kind of like, I don't know. It might have been cheaper because they might be folding up. I don't know, but it looked like it was pretty cool, and
it looks solid enough. They had a deluxe one with two joysticks and for two player with like 150 games on it. That's the one I wanted, but that was sold out.
Yeah, and it was twice as expensive as well. And I'm like, I don't have the room or a second player or the need for 50 more games than what I'm already getting.
Everybody needs 50 more games.
It's a very eclectic mix. It's not like totally random. Like there's not like JRPGs in there or something in an arcade stick, but they did have Power Pigs of the Dark Ages, which I haven't seen since the Blockbuster days on the Super Nintendo. So yeah, I'm looking forward to checking that out. It's still sitting in a box on my table. But,
it showed up.
Yeah, it did. Nice. As well as Catherine's Valentine's Day present from 2021.
That's hilarious.
Well, I need to know what's this present?
I ordered her the super deluxe, huge, gigantic Scott Pilgrim game for the Switch.
That finally went out.
Yeah, we finally got it, and it was so heavy. It was like I picked it up from had to open it up because I was like, I'm not sure this is a video game, but no, it was like this like actual suitcase, like metal and you know whatever that other material is, and it was just like you put it down, it's like dunk, and it was just full of the stuff. She posted a bunch of pictures of it, and it's really cool.
Yeah, I got the stuff. You got the heart. Yeah, I got the stuff.
It's very much the stuff. But yeah, it's just funny because it's like, happy Valentine's Day last year.
Oh my God. She was such a good sport about it too. She's over here blogging about me like, oh, this is so great. I'm like, this sweetheart.
Uh-huh.
It's a hell of a gift,
the best
though.
Part is you bought it last year, you said, right?
Yep.
So you bought it last year. You got the, oh, Chris, baby, I love you vibes from just buying it then. And then you got them again when they actually showed up. You got twice the love for the same present. That's smart purchasing.
For $130, I hope so.
Yeah, but many people spend $130 on the day of. They give them the thing, go, baby, I love you. And then it's in the corner till the next year. And that's it. Yeah. You got twice the love for the same gift. You got to acknowledge that, man. That's a good hit.
Yeah. Thanks, Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, man. That game. I really wish that game got like a sequel or even a spiritual successor.
Yeah. It seems like it's really solid. And plus, she's got the soundtrack, which is like, in my opinion, the best part.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I think we can all agree here that, I mean, whether you liked Scott Pilgrim, the narrative or not, if they just took, you know, every other element that game had, i.e. the soundtrack, the art and the game style, and just expanded on it with a brand new narrative, new world, all that, it'd be freaking sweet. Like, you don't even need it to be Scott Pilgrim, which is why I'm just like shocked he didn't jump on it and do it again.
Yeah, it's a good like beat 'em up from like what became a very specific era. Like that style of like, I guess, beat 'em up revivals like really kind of came and went. I mean, it kind of came back a little bit with like the revival of like, you know, River City Girls and Streets of Rage 4, but those are like I don't know, it's like a little different in a sense.
Well, there's that new Ninja Turtles game coming, so there's another one.
Yeah, I want to play that too, even though I haven't played a new Ninja Turtles game since they were new.
And then Way Forward has a game coming out called Dawn of the Monsters, which is supposed to be a pretty cool beat 'em up.
Neat.
Dawn of the Monster. Boop, boop, boop. I feel like, well, I will say that another thing, last thing worth noting about that, and then I know Joe's like, we got to segue. But
now I give up on segueing with you guys. Just fucking whatever.
Yeah, that's what I like to hear. Give up. No, but like the idea that, you know, for all these Beatles that everybody's trying to put out to get that retro vibe going, they all end up going for that same idea. Like you got a punch button, you got a jump button, your jump kick, your grab, you throw like the very basic staples of the genre. I mean, you got games like the River City Girls, which is based, which is built off of the River City Ransom format, and you have, of course, yes. Scout Pilgrim, which in this way is built off the River City Ransom formula. Expand more on that kind of thing if you want to get the retro vibes going. Just having the left to right side scroll, which is a punch, you know, knock them out. It's like, come on, guys, we could do better than that. Hell, it's at the point where I feel like, with as far as game design has come, they could just have classic arcade mode where you literally just go left to right and just mash, jump, and punch or whatever, and then have the expanded mode where it's like, here's the innovation for the beat-em-up style that we want to go with here. Got these cool moves. You have some freaking, I don't know, vertical dodging, which only like two fucking game had. Why is that so hard to implement in a beat-em-up? I don't know why. People don't get it. It's such a good thing to have.
What are those games? I don't even know one game that does that.
Fight and Rage and Streets of Rage 3 have it. Those are the two that have it. And it's why people like Streets of Rage 2 is better than 3. I'm like, you might say, you know, the music is better. You might say the graphics are better. I'm not going to cast question those things because I kind of get it. But as far as like gameplay is concerned, I've always been like 3 is better. And one of the reasons for that is that vertical dodge. It just makes sense to have in a beat 'em up. And I don't know why more people won't use it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I played Streets of Rage 3 and I just don't remember. That game was wacky.
It was really hard because, if I'm not mistaken, that was one of the ones where Sega was like, Americans like harder games, so let's just
I know.
And then everyone's playing, it's like, I don't like this game, it's too hard. I'm like, well, blame Sega for that. They screwed us.
Oh yeah. Well, Sega games are just hard to me. I don't know. It's like thinking about like all the Nintendo, like NES and Super NES games I've beaten over the years, like it's in the hundreds. I know that. I wouldn't say like 1,000 or something, but it's like, it's quite a lot. But like Genesis games, I think I've maybe beaten 10.
Wow.
10?
Yeah. Like I haven't beaten very many.
What is the two most prominent ones you could say that you've beaten? And when I say prominent, like games that you believe is such like, these are like big games to me.
I beat Toe Jam and Earl. That was a moment because that game is, it gets very hard, even in fixed mode.
Oh, like, I agree.
And let's see. I remember like the first one I beat was the original Sonic the Hedgehog with all the Chaos Emeralds.
Nice. Oh, wow.
Which is very hard, I believe.
It only changes the very last screen of the game, which is funny to me, but I still did it. I've beaten Shining Force like a bunch of times. I've beaten Phantasy Star 4, Shining Force 2, you know, like some of the RPGs I've beaten. And then, like, just thinking about action games, Gunstar Heroes, and God, one of the beat 'em ups, and I can't even remember which one. I'm telling you, it's a very small list.
I feel like with your emulation thing that you did, I don't think you do a lot of it. Yeah, you do both. You do normal and emulated, I think.
Yeah, I do everything, man.
With Genesis, if you're doing these live streams and stuff, the two games you need to play if you haven't played them before, because they're like top of my Genesis list, are Dynamite Heady and Kid Chameleon. Like, those are two that you need to take a shot at. Even if you don't finish them, you got to try them.
I know Dynamite Heady, but I have not. That's another game that's just bonkers.
Partly why you want to play it, because it's freaking absurd. And to this day, the absurdity holds up.
The beat 'em up that I have beaten is The Tick.
Ooh, I forgot about The Tick.
It's not good. Funny enough, Ben Edlund himself, the creator of The Tick, tweeted recently about how bad the video game adaptation is. So I feel like I'm qualified to say, having beaten both the Genesis and Super Nintendo versions, that they're not that good.
Which one's better?
Super Nintendo, because it has the better, I think it's just better overall. It's a little more polished. The voice samples are better. Like when he says spoon in the Genesis version, it's just like, it's this terrible grating sound, but it actually like sounds like a voice clip of, you know, of, oh crap, I blanked on the guy's name. Well, Michelangelo from the Ninja Turtles, the voice of The Tick.
Cowabunga.
I can't believe I forgot his name. But when he says it actually does sound like a sample of him saying it. So, you know. And the other one is Boogerman. I've beaten Boogerman on the Genesis. That one's great.
That game is hard as hell.
Yeah, it was pretty hard, but it has infinite continue, so I powered through it. Townsend Coleman, that's the voice of the Tick.
Mm.
My apologies to Townsend Coleman.
I've met him before, which is funny because I love the Tick.
You didn't know that it was Townsend Coleman?
I didn't know the person's name. Like, I've never heard that name before.
Oh, yeah, he's the voice of the Tick, and he's also Bebop and Michelangelo from the Ninja Turtles, Fred Wolf series.
You boss!
Yeah.
God, I love that voice. He is like the classic henchman voice that I always hear when, like, someone needs a voice for a henchman. I hear Bebop and or Rocksteady every time. It's, nice. It's classic. It's classic work.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, I don't know if you knew that the original Arthur in the Tick was Mickey Dolenz, who was of the band The Monkees.
People yeah, say he monkeys around.
Didn't yeah. Rob Paulsen take over for him?
He did, yeah, and you can't even tell because their voices are identical.
I love Rob but Paulsen.
Yeah, Rob Paulsen's great. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just you know, waxing nostalgic for the awesomeness of Rob Paulsen, that's all.
Oh, yeah, he's great. I haven't seen the new Animaniacs series yet, but it's nice that he's, like, back to voicing Yakko, because he had to have, like, actual, like, throat surgery and stuff.
Oh, wow.
Wait, so really? Seemed,
yeah, he had, like, I don't know if it was throat cancer, but it was, like, he had something real serious happening with his, like, throat and had to have surgery, and it was touch and go for a minute there.
Was this before or after he was doing that YouTube show?
Don't know the YouTube show, so I don't know.
So the YouTube show was, like, called, like, Talking Toons. And he would get like different voice actors on there with him, and they would just run lines and stuff. Like, one of my favorite ones was he had Katie Walgren on there, who did the voice for Haruko on the USFLCL and a number of other shows, including like the Cat and Infinity Train. Which, if you've never seen Infinity Train, fucking watch Infinity Train.
What is that? But, is that an anime?
No, it's a US cartoon. Ooh, and it's okay. About it's a four seasons, each episode is about 15 minutes long, so it's really short. And it's just about the adventures of different people on a train that will just randomly pick them up off the street and go into another dimension. And it's just a train that never stops and has infinite cars, and every car is its own universe.
All right, I wrote this.
You know what
down.
Else never stops? Tangents.
Here it is. That's probably David.
Tangents.
Unless somebody stops him, and that's where our guy Joe comes in, folks.
It was a tangent. I don't even remember what the original subject was.
I don't either. That's the beauty of
me
it.
Me being mad. My conspiracy theory.
Would you never even?
God damn it, Elden Ring.
I can talk a lot more about Elden Ring, but I also don't want Joe to murder me, so I'm not.
Oh, I would never murder you, Pernell. Maybe
just post.
You're gonna murder Brooke on International Women's Day?
Oh wow!
No, I wouldn't do that.
I just said I wouldn't murder her.
I'd murder her proxy, Ben.
I don't get it. I'm sorry. She doesn't get it, y'all.
It's okay. It was a weird joke. Just talk about it online, because I'm always about gabbing about that game. So
cool.
Oh, yeah.
So should we do reviews?
Yes, let's review it up. Then we can talk about Elden Ring.
If Tim were here, he would be sighing so much right now.
Yeah,
no, he'd be talking about Elden Ring.
It's actually hard to say.
Yeah, he'd be talking about Elden Ring. First game to talk about tonight is The Cruel King and the Great Hero, developed by Nipponichi Software, published by NIS America, released March 15th on the Switch and PS4 for $29.99. Join an intrepid girl on her many adventures as she strives to become a hero with the help of her mighty dragon protector. Along the way, meet new friends, collect items, and help folks from all walks of life discover a heartwarming tale of kindness, companionship, and family in a gorgeous hand-drawn world. Chris, tell us about your time with The Cruel King and The Great Hero.
Okay, The Cruel King and The Great Hero. I was pulling up a thing because I'm trying to remember The Liar and the Blind Prince. That's right. Okay, so this is the... we'll cut all that. Yeah, right?
No, I won't.
Yeah, I know.
Lazy.
This is the newest of a long line of two games from NIS Software and the developer whose name I can't remember now.
I just have it listed as Nipponichi Software. That's all
yeah,
I can find
that,
for
that,
it.
That's how they do it. That's okay. But yeah, this is an NIS game. The second in a kind of series, but not super related, but you know, like it very recognizable if you've played The Liar and the Blind Prince. I didn't get to review that one, so I'm not going to talk about it, but it has the, it has like that kind of same appealing, like this very nice storybook looking animation, you know, really pleasant soundtrack, just a really, really lovely game to look at. However, the difference in tone and also like gameplay is pretty stark. So like, honestly, if you know, it is actually preferred to go into this game without knowing about the Liar and the Blind Prince, I assume, because I, again, didn't play it. But whereas that one is a puzzle platformer, this is a JRPG, and so I'm happy about that. So this one follows a little girl whose name is Yu. That's Y-U-U. But, you know, the wordplay is not lost on me. She, due to tragedy, has no parents and has been living under the protection of a giant dragon. The Dragon King, which they don't specify if he's a king that just happens to be a dragon or if he actually rules dragons in some way. His jurisdiction is not clearly defined in the parts of the game I've played. But basically, he is a, he's an adoptive parent. He's very, very protective and loving of this little girl who has designs to become a legendary adventurer like her father before her. Which she knows from stories that the dragon tells her. So basically what the game kind of is that you disembark from your cave every day, because the gameplay takes place across like days where you like kind of turn in at the end of the day and things like that. It's very cute. And she runs down the hill with her stick and later a wooden sword and a pot on her head. And which, by the way, you can upgrade the pot, which is great. You can go from like a dented pot to a shiny pot, etc. It's very good. And she goes down into the monster village to... God, my cat is destroying things. Hang on.
Sounds like you went down to the monster village.
I want to hear the cat destroy stuff. Let's move the microphone over to...
One of our emotes is me wearing a pot on my head, so that's pretty fun.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah, I'm going to go use that emote right now.
Hell yeah. Okay, so basically you go down into the monster village and you get to know the monsters who live there. And you can do like side quests for them and things like that. Acts of kindness literally is what they call like the side quests in the game. It's all about like getting to know these monsters and like, you know, befriending them and doing cool things for them and stuff and actually doing things that are like more worthwhile, like, saving a fox family from a feverish like disease by getting some flowers for them, like some actually restorative flowers and like different things like that. And again, it's a JRPG. The best way I can describe it is like Paper Mario, because you're running around in a side-scrolling type of map. It's not like it's not a top-down type of thing at all. Battles are random, however, so you don't actually like hit enemies with hammers to get a good start or something like that. Instead, you and whomever else is in your party just basically get to take turns, like either doing regular attacks or special moves. The special moves are kind of cool because here's the thing about this game is that as you're walking through this lovely storybook world and like, you know, kind of running around, literally running if you are higher level than the enemies in the stage. Like, that's a weird way that they kind of allow you to skip battles, is that once you're strong enough or if you've beaten the area or something, you can then run through it and then the enemies can't catch you is the lore. But you can always, in the background as the player, you can see like the Dragon King just kind of skulking around in the background, keeping an eye on his adoptive daughter. And when you do things in battle, like let's say you do a flame slash, you can see the dragon in the background shoot a little bitty flame that lights her sword on fire, and then she hits the enemy. And it, you know, so she thinks it's her power, but it's actually coming from this dragon that's basically the ultimate helicopter parent, but like a helicopter equipped with missiles.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, so it's like really cool like that. And you know, as the story unfolds, it becomes, you know, more complex and more of an actual story. It's not just, you know, daily adorableness or anything like that. But yeah, it's a game with a whole lot of heart. It's very heavily emphasized on like storytelling and kind of world building. The actual RPG action, I mean, I honestly would would put this in the camp of like baby's first RPG, you know, like a Paper Mario or a Final Fantasy Mystic Quest. It's just, it's not complicated.
Doesn't mean it's bad though.
No, of course not. And it's just nice how like it kind of opens up the world by like removing, like it's literally just monsters being like, oh, you're not allowed to go in there. And then like the next day they might not be there. So you can now explore a new area. And, you know, you can buy new items that do things. Your partners do things like get you across, like, world obstacles, like, you know, flying you across a particularly long ditch or something like that. And, yeah, it's just, like, it's adorable and it's engaging. It's not a world beater, but it's definitely something that I'm enjoying and would really like to see the end of.
Cool. Well, it's $30, comes out next week. What do you think of it?
I mean, $30 for a NIS RPG, that's actually pretty good. That's very, very reminiscent of how they treated the Liar and the Blind Prince. But the Liar and the Blind Prince is a little darker in tone. I think this one's maybe a little lighter in tone, unless there's some plot twist that's coming, in which case I'll amend my review later. Because I'm definitely going to play
through. Well, it is an E10 rated game, so I don't expect anything too horrific to come down the pike.
No, I really don't think so. Yeah, this is just a really lovely game. And like I said, I would absolutely recommend this for like the younger set. The only real downsides to it are just budgetary things. So like, you know, the frame rate is a little slow, but I mean, it moves like a storybook. They move like they're animated by hand, you know, so that's not really a detriment. And also the voice acting is one narrator who only speaks Japanese. It's not English at all. The text is English, but yeah, you're gonna, you know, it's a really good narration. I mean, with the limited understanding of Japanese I have, you can feel the beats of the story and stuff, and it's kind of nice to listen to even if you don't understand it. So I actually kind of like the Japanese narration as well, but yeah, they couldn't spring for an English voice actor, I suppose. So, but, no, I'm going to give it a buy it because this game's really special and I really enjoy it. So there you go.
All right, well, next up is Monster Crown, developed by Studio Aurum, published by Sidesco, releasing this one already released February 22nd on Xbox One and PS4 for $29.99. Unravel Crown Island's dark stories. You create your own monster legacy with the history of sadistic rulers and heroic saviors. The island faces another threat in the form of a malicious young woman seeking power. It's up to you and the monsters you make pacts with to prevent the return of tyranny. Will your decisions make you a savior or a dark messiah? Pernell, which are you?
I'm a guy who's grinding monsters. That's about the gist of it.
You're not supposed to grind, Pernell.
Hey, guess what?
I knew you were going to say that.
I knew he was, but then that just shows Joe doesn't know monster taming games, because this is the kind of game you do grind in, because it's all about seeing.
You just have
crazy
to explore, Pernell. You have to explore and see the world.
Time to explain this game so you know why the fuck you're wrong. So the idea behind this game is that you are a young man who is starting off on his adventure to sort of become a monster tamer. Think general Pokemon style. And if you do think that, another reason why it's good to go that direction is because the design of the game is meant to resemble a Game Boy Color RPG style game, like the old Pokemon games. You're off on your adventure in order to. Initially, it's not even really about becoming a master tamer. It's more about just like doing errands for your family. It has a full-on narrative in that sense. But over the course of your adventure of doing these like simple tasks, the, you know, stakes get raised, things change, and the next thing you know, you're actually fighting for the fate of the island that you live on. But before any of that nonsense, this is a monster battling game. And believe it or not, coming into this, I had heard good things about it, but I wasn't expecting too much to be different, but to be honest, it kind of does do a few things differently. So let's go down to the beats as to what this is all about as far as combat goes. So the game has the monsters that are available have one of five different traits, the names of which I never remember, so I'm just going to read them off of the actual notebook in the game, because seriously, I do not remember them, and I suck at using them in battle too. You have Will, Brute, Malicious, Unstable, and Relentless. Those are the types of monsters in Monster Crown. Now, of course, there's a whole tree of which moves are strong against others and which ones are weak against others, but I ain't going down that road. Anyway, when you get in the situation while you're running around the map, monsters are visibly present on the actual world map itself. And when you come across them, you'll enter a skirmish and a battle will take place. Now, your monster will have a variety of different moves available that are associated with those different, you know, those typings. And you'll want to use the one that's strong against them, while hopefully not taking a hit from one that your monster's weak against. Now, one cool thing about this game is that if you decide you want to switch monsters, so another different, did you want to choose a monster in your party that may have a better advantage on the monster you're fighting, or if you defend for that matter, you'll actually get a bit of a, you'll get a knock on a 4-bar gauge, and that will allow you to build up strength in your next attack further and further and further. So it's so much so that you can pretty much like swap your monsters back and forth just to get a decent juicing. Of course, the downside is you're taking hits every round. You're not actually doing something. But what I like about that is that in a Pokemon game, that's generally disincentivizing. Like if you switch to another Pokemon that's not going to outright absorb the damage somehow, you're taking a hit with no actual gain from it, except for whatever you had you can do on future turns. But in this game, it's like even though you're going to take the hit, you're actually going to be able to do more damage with the next hit. And if you make a bad switch and you decide to switch again, the next monsters are going to be even stronger with their next attack. So it's not a full loss if you got to switch monsters around to find the one that's going to fit for that turn in battle. Aside from the fact you have a team of 8 monsters, it's still 1v1 battle. So your monster against their monster, unless you need to switch them around and whatnot, but it's always 1v1 aside from the switching and all that. And when you fight enough monsters and you win, you'll level up and you'll learn new monster moves and things of that nature, like the usual thing. But here's what I really think is cool about this game compared to, you know, like the Pokemon and other games of that ilk. Eventually, you gain access to your family's farm and you'll become able to actually breed your monsters. Now, in this game, like in Pokemon, I got to make the distinction because it's a very important difference. In Pokemon, when you breed 2 monsters, you'll get one of those 2 monsters as the response, or a baby form of one with a variety of moves that could have been born from the parents. In this game, you legitimately get a new freak of nature. And I'm not exaggerating. They come out, it's like, what's this thing's name? Because it doesn't have a name. It didn't exist until you birthed it. and I can't express how much I like that concept. The fact that I can take 2 monsters that look completely different, put them together, and get a freak. It's amazing. And
you're
I love
playing
my
God, Purnell. You're playing God.
It really leaves you wondering just how many monster designs this game actually has built into it. Because, like, for example, I've taken a 1 primary monster and then bred it with 3 different sub-monsters and got 3 completely different monsters. Not like the same monster with a different palette. I mean, completely different monsters, which blew my mind. And they get a combination of the moves that the other monsters had, and you'll get update their base stat growth and all that stuff. And then you can take the birth monster and breed with other monsters, whether they were whether they ran them like a generation line or if it's a brand new monster. And it actually keeps track of how many generations this monster has had built into it.
Wow.
It's ridiculous, and I love it. And that's where the grind comes in for this game, because this is the kind of game where the reason why you're grinding isn't just to get a bigger number, though that will happen too, because you'll want to see your babies grow, but you'll just want to see a bunch of new monsters. You'll be like, hey, I got this thing, and I got this weird thing. I wonder how many weird things I can make with
Let's
those.
Let's see what mutant freak monsters. Baby I could make with these things.
Yes, it's freaking great. And the currency, at least from what I could tell, I could be wrong, and if they're game makers listening, they can be like, you're crazy, Purnell. But I believe the currency that allows you to keep doing this, there's like a monster like taming score, or not taming, but like a monster stat that it relates to like your fame or whatever. You get that from battling randos on the map or by doing rump story battles or whatever. And that actually grows and is displayed at the bottom of your screen at times. And that decreases bit by bit every time you do a farming or a breeding scenario. But I have a ton of it. I've never really run out of it, so I haven't been concerned about it. And another thing I should mention is that in addition to the fact that you can breed monsters and get new monsters, there are actually evolution items that will also change the monsters too. And they work in a weird way. Like some items only work on some monsters but not others. And you can use the item in battle to get the evolution only for that battle. And kind of, I guess the whole point of that is to see what the battle monster, what the monster looks like and how it works, if you're comfortable with it. Or you can use the item on the monster outside of combat and the transformation will be permanent. The monster changes form, it gets new stats, it may even get a new move. It's just a kind of a cool thing. Like, I used an atomic clock on my Gorgum gym. It became this really big-headed gym monster where his mouth is, before the mouth was bigger than the head, now the head is bigger than the mouth. It's crazy, people. It's like, I just like this game. It's a legitimately good time. The story does get dark and it tries to, but I mean, at the end of the day, it's a freaking Game Boy Color looking game. No matter how dark it gets, it's not really going to mess with you, but so much. But the game is fun. I mean, again, you just got to come into it knowing that it is a retro style adventure, but I mean, honestly, that's what you're going to get when you're coming. You already know what's going on. The only downside I need to mention is that I did come across a few like glitches. Nothing that breaks the game or makes it unplayable or anything. Just stupid things. Like, I was in a house. There was like a little small narrative where like a couple was going to elope and the parents weren't happy with it. And I talked to the parents. Or I talked to the daughter. Then I talked to the parents. The daughter leaves the house and then the two elope. And I was like, oh man, I wonder what the parents are going to say about that. So I ran back to the house, talked to the dad. The dad had the daughter's lines from the previous scene. So I was like, whoops, well, I guess I'll never know how the dad feels about this elopement. Whatever. Back to breeding. And then, like, aside from that, there's this other thing I've noticed that's kind of weird. I don't know what triggers it, but my best guess is if there's a person you can talk to and you're going into a menu or something next to them, when you leave the menu, their dialogue will immediately trigger. It's a small thing. It's just strange, but something to mention. But aside from that, this has been a good time to me. I like the game. I like seeing what the new monsters look like. It's cool. Like, I could mention the whole thing about, well, you don't catch them in Pokeballs. You form packs with them. But really, the packs work like Pokeballs. You use the pack on them, and either they take the agreement or they don't. I mean, that's just the
simple. Sign your life away, monster. Okay.
I'm down, buddy.
YOLO. Like, fuck it. Let's do this. Are you going to mate me with something?
You don't belong in this world.
I'm giving them three hots in the cot. They're not going to hate on that.
These monsters, you're getting them laid too, man. Like,
that is true. They're getting a better life than I'm having. You're
playing God, and is it worth $30 to play God, Purnell?
I will say, if you're really hardcore in the monster games and the whole, you know, Pokemon-y things, definitely a buy it. But if you're the type of person going to hear this and go, oh, retro, then wait for a sale. But at the end of the day, it is worth playing. I will say that. It's just a matter of you choosing how the value of it works for you. But I think it's worth 30 bones.
Cool. And earlier, I thought you said Polkamon, like the music Polka. Then I just want to hear Polka-themed Pokemon music.
I mean, I'm surprised.
Let's get Weird Al on the job.
Life hasn't done it.
I do have a friend that plays accordion.
There you go.
Let's make this happen. All right, next game is Legend of Ixtona, developed by Worldwide Software, published by Chemco, released March 4th on Xbox One, Series X and S, and Windows 10 for $14.99. Peace was supposed to prevail in the lands of Ixtona after a long war came to an end under the wise king, until a sudden plot and conspiracy threaten again its peace. Kyle, the Prince of Ixtona, now has to throw himself and his allies into a battle that will ultimately decide the fate of his kingdom. Chris, this is a Chemco game that's not developed by Hit Point or X-Create. This is
I know.
We got Worldwide Software on this job. How are they doing? Is it a fun game? How'd everything turn out?
Let me tell you right quick about how rare it is for a worldwide like software game. Like, there's several of them, of course. You know, Chemco pumps these things out way too fast for them not to have 20 games out there. But the last time we reviewed one was freaking Symphony of Eternity on the 3DS. It's been about 5 or 6 years at this point. Yeah. This is Legend of Ixtona, which, interestingly as well, another rarity for a Chemco RPG. This is a strategy RPG, not a standard turn-based JRPG. So we're just, you know, we're wading out into like unfamiliar waters, although the waters are only ankle deep, so it's not really a big deal. So yeah, in this game, I feel like they're underselling the plot a little bit. The Prince Kyle is forced out of his, not forced out of his kingdom so much. He's not banished. He's just given dominion over a small village by his brother, who murders their father in broad daylight. The surprise of no one. Apparently, everybody was in on this plot except Kyle, and so he sends him off. But interestingly, I want to touch on one thing before talking about this game. So we almost had a kind of a third really, huge departure from our usual Chemco RPGs, in that this one starts off with a character creator, not with Kyle. You are made to, or you're asked to make a character, choose from a set of jobs. It's a job system, kind of like a Final Fantasy Tactics, basically. And you can choose your gender. So you can actually have a female character that you create and name prior to the adventure. And I was for sure thinking, okay, so she's going to be like the protagonist. Finally, a Chemco RPG where you get to play as a female protagonist. I was like, at last, like, you know, but then it starts the story and they're like, oh, by the way, you're Kyle and you're the prince of the realm. And yeah, I was like, oh, great. Thanks. Interestingly, your character is introduced after a few battles, having come from a totally different place with a mysterious backstory and two other characters. So that's it's an intriguing thing that the character that you named is not, at least for the most part, is not the protagonist. However, the main protagonist does go off outside of the story for a while. So, like, yeah, you do kind of get to function as more or less a group, a motley crew of misfits and ragamuffins.
I'm looking at a bunch of screenshots for the game, and I'm enjoying some of the names. I see Ash, Kyle. The one that caught my attention is Shizzle.
Shizzle, yes. He is a demon Nizzle? Boy.
Like, yes. Do you do things for Shizzle?
Yeah. Well, you have to... You have to beat the Shizzle out of him before he'll join your party. He's one of those starts off as the enemy, but then when you're victorious, the mermaid that joins your party, actually your first party member is a mermaid who climbs out of the water because she thinks that Kyle is so cute that she's like, I'm going to give up my aquatic life just to be near this guy and cast badass like water magic near him. But then you find out that she actually finds everybody cute. So she's actually an equal opportunity siren nice. Of the sea. But yeah, her name is Meltia. And she's adorable. I love her. And yeah, she apparently has this past with Shizzle. And so she literally extorts him into joining the group as your as your demon sorcerer who can also fly. He's a flying unit. So a flying unit with magic. I was like, great. That's awesome. I love it. And yeah, there's a couple other different interesting characters. Like I said, your named character shows up with another character who is a thief type, which was convenient for me because I chose a thief. So I had two thieves at this point join my party within like three battles. I'm like, perfect. And then they're also joined by a mysterious automaton, which is like a little floaty orb with wings. It looks like a shmup, like spaceship. And he's got like a voice going through a synthesizer and stuff. It's actually kind of cool. The voice acting is in Japanese, but even so, his voice acting is done through a synthesizer, so you absolutely know it's him. And he's a very, I guess, a C-3PO kind of character, a very put-upon robot who transports through time and space, and so that kind of introduces this whole other element to the storyline. But yeah, basically after every battle, like, it's just like Final Fantasy Tactics in the sense that you get some plot, there's some political intrigue that's about as shallow as ankle deep water, and you get thrown around a map with like blue and red dots on it. You know, blue dots are towns, red dots are the action. And then you can basically, once you go to a new area, you might fight something there, and then you can always revisit it and do another fight. Experience levels, it goes by Shining Force rules. As you gain levels and fight easier enemies, your experience goes down, so you have to keep challenging yourself to keep your levels up. However, there's also, on top of getting money, there's also a crafting system in play So that you can gather materials and kind of get weapons that are really good early, if you're diligent about collecting and stealing the necessary things. If not, don't worry about it. Just buy them in the next couple of towns, you know? Like, it's not a super challenging game, at least on the normal difficulty that I played it on. It does have difficulty levels, including an easier mode if you're a newbie to SRPGs. But yeah, like, characters keep joining, and you also have you can also utilize the character creator to, like, fill out the rest of your party with any one of, you know, five different jobs. You can change jobs for characters when they get to a certain level. Jobs unlock abilities and passive stat increases that can be equipped onto a character up to three. So you can kind of customize your characters in that way. It's actually really tight. It's quite nice. And the interesting thing about it is that very quickly, like, while regular enemies basically stay just, you know, a few hit points above your characters and, you know, you kind of trade blows and stuff, when it comes to a boss character, they're given, like, thousands of hit points, and it takes your whole army to take them down. It's like that the later parts of Final Fantasy Tactics, where it's like the regular enemies, okay, not a big deal, but then the boss comes out and you're just like, okay, we all got to pile onto this guy and, you know, keep those priests, like, at distance, healing up everybody, and, you know. And by the way, all of the magic in the game is done through basically kind of like a turn. Like, it's a skill point system that's on a timer based on turns rather than a strict, like, MP, like, pool. So you can either cast a spell right away or, you know, skip your turn and get a few more points to cast an even better spell in the next turn. It also has certain defense buffs that can happen. Like, all the different jobs and characters have a lot of cool little things that they can offer to the battlefield. So it's not just, you know, run up and just attack all of them and overpower them. It's like there's real strategy to be had here. So I really, really enjoy that. Yeah, it's a game that's really deep on strategy. It's a little light on, you know, like, the overall storyline is very intriguing, but, like, character to character, like, they're not super fleshed out, so, and plus a lot of them are just kind of anonymous soldiers that you literally can just send away to do quests for more experience points outside of your party. Again, like some of the Final Fantasy Tactics games. And although I haven't beaten it myself, I've read elsewhere that it's about an 8 to 12 hour game, so it's actually on the short side. That's really the only complaint I would have about this game, would be the brevity, because, you know, strategy RPGs tend to go to epic lengths for sure.
Yeah.
But apart from that, this got me. I really enjoyed it.
Cool. It's $15. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, $15 is an easy buy it. I mean, there's not a lot of strategy RPGs out there of any quality under the, like, $30 or $40 range. Plenty above, of course. But yeah, for this one, you know, if you haven't picked up Triangle Strategy yet and you're wanting to scratch that itch, this will be a real good one to load up for the week.
Cool. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Next game to talk about is Gunborg Dark Matters, developed by Rick Pau Studios, published by Red Art Games, released March 4th on the Xbox One, Series X and S, Switch, PS4, PS5, and PC for $14.99. Harness the power of dark energy as you jump, slash, shoot, and bombard your way through an army of alien soldiers and killer robots in an arcade-style action platformer with a slick 80s synthwave soundtrack. Purnell, tell us about your time with Gunborg Dark Matters.
Talking about hard-ass games, ta-da! Here's a slap in the face right here. Gunborg Dark Matters is a game where you play as a young heroine. Honestly, I don't know what these characters' names are, so don't kill me. But you play as a really cool heroine who is running through this spaceship, tearing through it on a mission to retrieve a critter. Just like this little cute critter thing. And this is done through a series of stages that are in different parts of the ship. Though they generally don't look all that different, mostly just like color palette swaps, and of course their configurations, but I digress. You're running through the ship, going from level to level, and the actual gameplay of this title is pretty awesome and frenetic. You have essentially the thumbstick for moving around. The right thumbstick is to move, to control the direction that you are facing, and this is important because the left trigger controls your main weapon, which is a sword. And depending on the direction you're facing, you will swing your sword in that direction. Right bumper controls a shield, also is released in the direction you're facing. The shield stays up for a limited amount of time while you're holding down the button. So you can't just hold the button and run indefinitely with the shield because it is on a timer. And they did that intentionally so you didn't just run around with the shield out all the time.
Yeah.
Now, the cool thing about the shield in this game, and then I'll get to the weapon stuff, is that the shield actually has three functions in this game. It can deflect gun attacks, and by deflect, I mean actually send the bullets back to the attacker. So you can kill people with their own bullets. You can actually run directly into the enemies with the bullets or with the shield. I was thinking like, screw this, I don't got time. I'm running. It's like smack with the shield so they die. But then lastly, this game has tons of spikes everywhere. Spikes are all over the place. And the shield actually can be used for up to three hits to surf on the spikes. So if you need to cross a spike pit, surf, 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 you can just use the shield for that. And that is honestly a really cool feature for the shield to be able to do. Now, in addition to those things, so I also got to mention the one thing that bugs me, but it makes sense in the gameplay perspective, is jumping is the left trigger. Now, when you kill enemies that have guns, and most of the enemies have a firearm of some sort, you can actually walk up on that gun, hit the left bumper button, and you can pick up the weapon and use that instead of the sword. So you're basically getting new guns on the fly. And believe it or not, it's not a bad thing when I say it, though usually it would be. The enemies aren't randomly generated, but the guns they're holding actually are. So you can't necessarily just like run through a level and be like, well, I know that guy's going to give me the homing shot this time, so I'll just keep killing him and get it until I get it right. Nah, this time you might have the rapid fire gun.
This time you might have the gun.
Yeah, it's really cool because the entire point of it, at least in my opinion, is to have you thinking on the fly. Like, I got this gun. Like, you ever see those like action movies where the hero runs into a gunfight and he punches the guy and snaps his neck and then takes the gun he was holding, and now he's got a gun. He's shooting two guys. And he runs over. He gets behind the table. The guy he shot had a gun, so now he picks that up. He's got a new gun, and then he's got to use that gun to do things. That same momentum happens in this game where you're just like running through these scenarios, these battle sequences that take place in certain rooms where they kind of like box you in and make you fight waves, where you're just like, dodge, jump, dodge, move. Kill this guy. Oh, crap, I got a grenade launcher. Start blasting fuckers with grenade launcher. Now I got the rapid fire gun. Use that thing. And you're just like playing everything on the fly. And it is really cool how that happens. And you're basically just doing these motions to run through levels. You take three hits and you die, though some enemies will drop hit points. Now, in addition to the things I just mentioned, there's also a few other things worth mentioning. There are three little pickup guys you got to find on a level. We don't have to, but you know, the usual three-star or bonus item. There's three little objects that are floating around, the little info bots. And if you pick all those up, you'll get a score bonus at the end of the level. And they will also influence your combo meter. Because as you kill enemies, a combo meter will go up in the game. And it goes up to a maximum of three. If you spend time not killing guys, the meter will slowly go down. The combo meter's purpose is to increase your score for killing things. But also, once you get a multiplier of three, you go into dark energy mode, hence the title. Oh, I said the title of the game! And dark energy mode will give you, like, again, a three times score bonus, but also increase power in your shots or sword swings. So it is very beneficial to get times three multiplier if you can pull it off. And again, those info bots do contribute to that, which is a great thing. At the end of every level, you will be graded on your performance. It's hard to get really good scores. So I will say, for most of the levels, if I finally manage to get to the end, I have been able to pull off some A's. But the S likely will require you to not die on the level. So good luck with that. Because every time I beat a level, it'll tell you the score difference between your current score and your next score, or your current grade and your next grade. And that grade gap is generally pretty wide for me when it's going between A and S. So
Carnage is asking if you've gotten an S rank yet.
The very first level, I believe I did. And that was the only level I pulled it off. It was like, it gets progressively harder. And it's one of those games where it's like, early on, you're like, I want to get the highest rank on every level. I can do this. I can do this. And you become that perfectionist. And then eventually it's like, C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. And you just run it. You just run it. You take the score knowing you could always come back. But if you don't come back, it just means you didn't want it badly enough. And that's freaking fine. Because you're going to die a lot. You're going to repeat sections a lot. And if you don't have the tenacity for that, I'm sorry. But if you do have the tenacity for that, it is a fantastic ride because, again, you'll die 10 times, but when that one death or that one successful run comes through and the frenetic pace of the motions go into your, you know, just run through your brain pan, it feels sweet. You feel like you accomplished something great. And it's just that sort of thing where if you were recording it, someone would come and go, oh, wow, this guy's amazing. Not knowing you cut the other 9 attempts off just to show the perfect one, because that's how you're supposed to do it. It's a gem. Like, I love games like that. And when people ask me things like, why do you like playing these games that are so challenging? That's the drug I'm looking for when I play those games. You don't always beat them. And you don't always get to the, you don't always even see the end of it, let alone beating it. But the moments that you succeed are the moments that feel great. And it's not about, I only want to play the game because I only want to play fun games. Because in that sense, this is the fun. The fun is the successful attempt that you make. The ingredients to that are the failures. You have to fail a few times to experience the success. And that success feels much better knowing that you had to grow to the point where you could pull it off. And that's also why I like the fact that even though you're penalized by having the bad grade, or not even a bad grade, just a lower grade by dying a lot, that's really your only penalty. You get kicked back to the checkpoint, and the checkpoints are fairly generous. So you're just like, oh, try it again. Oops, try it again. Oops, try it again. Until you get it right. And it feels good. And it's not wasting your time with each new attempt. You're just giving it another go. The game doesn't have a ton of levels, but like I mentioned before, with the amount of times you're going to die and figure stuff out, there's enough levels. You'll put the time in on your failure to success road. It's fun. At the end of the day, this game to me was another one of those surprise reviews where, to be perfectly honest, and this is to the developer's credit, I looked at the pictures and you're like, hey, you want to look at this game? I was like, yeah, it's another one of those. Sure, let's try it. And I booted it up. And it was just me trying to boot up for 30 minutes before going to bed just to see what I got myself into. I played for 2 hours and was really into the OST. The OST is fucking sweet, by the way. That synthwave is the tits. It's good. Recommended it. But the game is solid. The game in motion, the game both visually in motion and you feeling it as you play it, great. I wholeheartedly recommend this game. It deserves credit. It deserves kudos. And to me, it's kind of a sleeper because I didn't even hear of it until you mentioned it. So I'm glad we got to talk about it today because I want people to play it. Just know you're going to suffer to succeed, but the suffering is worth it to eventually succeed.
Well, is it worth $15?
You're goddamn right. Buy it.
Cool. Works for me.
Yeah.
Fucking yeah.
Fucking yeah. We got to get the sound effect. Pernell, what do you think of the game? Is it good?
Fucking yeah.
That's right. Right? Right, Pernell?
Fucking yeah.
Right, Pernell?
Fucking yeah. Fucking yeah. Fucking yeah.
Just imagine it.
Fucking yeah.
I'm the one who said it, and I just imagine it myself.
Fucking yeah.
All right, moving on. Next game to talk about is Primordia, developed and published by Wadjet-i Games, released March 2nd on the Switch for $14.99. In a post-apocalyptic world bereft of life, two robots undertake an epic journey to a fabled city of glass and light. Brooke, what is Primordia?
It's really, 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 really good, dude. This is an awesome game. Sorry to give spoilers for the very end, but I really love this. Before I get into why I liked it and what it's about, I want to give everyone on the show right now and in the chat one guess as to what the name of our ship is in Primordia. You get one hint. It's a word that's very special to the show, a word close to our hearts that keeps coming back to haunt us over and over again every week.
I'm going to initially start with my nuts.
He got it. It's unique.
I was going to start with a critic joke like, oh no, Primotheus.
I wish, dude. Unique is like an acronym. I can't remember what it stands for, but it's UNNIC. But as soon as I loaded up the game and I saw that, I was like, oh, hell yeah. They're going to love this.
UNNICY. Another reference.
Okay,
Queen Latifah.
I'm loving it.
That's right.
Okay.
Insert rap lyrics here and you're good.
This game has a lot going for it. Like, it's honestly knocking it out of the park in several directions here. But the one place where it's knocking it out of the park the most. This game has just got like incredible art. Like this is probably the art I'm most impressed of, I want to say, about any game. Like it's not got the budget of something like Elden Ring, but they're doing a lot. This game came out in 2012 and the graphics are just like insanely good. Like the art's just incredible. It's really doing its own thing. If you're listening, Google image search this game so you can see what I'm talking about. This is really hard to explain. It's got kind of this weird perspective, like almost Salvador Dali thing going on. It's like if every scene in this game was coming from a really interesting angle and perspective that like really gave you a sense of space, even if you're looking at different rooms and scenes that are the same size on your screen. Like it's really like it. I really love it when art is original and like not based in realism, but is still getting the ideas across and immersing you in it all the more. So like, it just, it freaked me out how good the art is in this game. It's like in every scene in the game, someone waved a magic wand over the art and cast a spell to make it sort of remind you of the Dali famous melting clocks painting. The art just took my breath away, you guys. I really loved it. I've gotten really lucky on my review games since joining the show last year. A couple of the games I've gotten from Joe have just shot to be at the very top of like certain categories of games that I like. Or I'll be like, oh, this is just an insane story. This has got like really great characters. This game's definitely like, it's got to at least be in my top five art of all games. It's really incredible. You started in your ship, which is being hijacked by another robot who wants to steal your ship's power core after y'all get robbed. This is like the first scene of the game, so I'm not thinking spoilers here. I got to just give you all the premise. After you get robbed, you're regrouping with your little floating robot sidekick friend, Crispin, who is a robot you personally invented and built. You're also a robot, by the way. Humanity's over. We're all robots now. We kind of got a post-apocalyptic thing going on here, but also not really, because it would have to be so post-apocalyptic that we're all robots and we've made a new society and humanity is a distant, weird memory. So y'all are rolling around trying to get your emergency generator back up, because now that the ship's power source has been taken, you're both going to run out of battery soon. Your little robot sidekick is dissing you the whole time, adding a lot of comic relief, and y'all have what's understood to the player to be just a really long-running rapport of you basically being the straight man and him pissing you off, but you love him anyway. Then he's like, hey, boss, how about instead of killing ourselves trying to scrape together enough power to live a little longer, why don't we just go to Metropol, the city of glass and light, where there's free power for one and all? To which you reply, yo, don't believe everything you hear on the radio, little man. That place is not what it seems. I hate that place. And that's really when the story starts getting really creepy and deep. The story's got a lot going on. Got some insane world building, probably the craziest world building I can think of for a point-and-click adventure game, which is what we're dealing with here. Story's amazing. Sound design's really good. Art's just ridiculous, unfairly good. It's not even fair to other games. Characters are great. Dialogue's great. It's doing a lot. It's funny when it's supposed to be funny. It's scary when it's supposed to be scary. It's immersive. It's interesting. Let me take a drink of water here. I'm just freaking out, you guys.
The storyline sounds a lot like an American Tale. You know, there are no cats in America.
Ooh, that's good. I wouldn't have put those together, but that just brought like a big old smile on my face, dude. I'm just grinning like a motherfucker over here. So yeah, really, like all the stuff coming together, I really can't say enough good things about this game. On the other side of the coin, I have one single complaint about this game. I can only say one bad thing about it, but I don't think it's very bad. I don't think it's going to be bad for everyone, but I do think it's worth noting here. You know, comparing this game to Unforeseen Incidents, this is another really cool, beautiful, immersive point-and-click adventure game that I reviewed for the show a few weeks ago. That deals a lot with the same thing you're dealing with in this game, which is dealing with like mechanics and electronics and soldering and getting conduits and attaching them to things. By the way, I had to look up what a conduit is. I did not know. you know, it's pretty hard, and it's hard even if you do look up what different pieces of machinery do and what the connections really even would be there. I want to compare it to Unforeseen Incidents because you're playing a really techie guy in Unforeseen Incidents, and you're having to solder things together, and you're going to have to put electronics together. You're going to have to fix a car, which is something I've never done in real life. I'm lucky if I know what part the engine is when I pull up the trunk. But even if I'm out of my
league, filled up the gas tank once. I was pretty impressed.
Nice. Hey, I'm impressed. But yeah, I mean, like, even though I've never seen some of the stuff in Unforeseen Incidents, and I've never, like, opened a car, like I haven't fixed a car or anything, it did a good job of bridging the gap between who I was and who the player was to make me feel like the player. And even if I don't know how to do something in real life, and something would never occur to me, I feel like this game's learning curve is really steep for people who aren't already like handy and messing around with electronics. I thought it was a little steep to the tune of within 2 hours of the game, I really was stuck, and I had to look something up to get myself forward. And I really, like, when I'm stuck on a review game, I better be stuck for a couple hours, dude, because I don't want to look up any hints or anything when I'm like having my experience of the game. And I like, I know you're not going to be mad at me if I have to look stuff up to get through it, but like, I want to give
how
an honest
review. How dare you?
Now he's really mad, man. But like, we wouldn't have much of a review right now if I hadn't looked up a couple things. I would have gotten stuck and stayed stuck within the first couple hours of gameplay. So if you've been listening for a long time, I have given a deny it to a game that I couldn't complete without looking things up. So why do I think this game is so good if I did have to look things up to get myself unstuck, to get to the next point? And the only answer I can give to that is content. This game has so much content. If you need to look something up for a hint, if you need to wedge yourself further a little bit more, it's probably going to be occasionally, and you're going to have hours of, like, I don't know how long this game would take a real genius to, like, put together, like, maybe 4 hours. But, like, it took me a lot longer to get through big parts of the story here. And even if I had to look up a couple things to, like, wedge myself ahead, I still felt like the game was worth it. I at no point was like, oh, I'm so mad I can't get this. This is a deal breaker for me. Like, I don't think it's a game breaker. I don't think it's a deal breaker. And I'm going to give this a glowing review, even though I did have that issue with it, which I think that's a pretty big issue to have with a point and click adventure game, because there's not a lot going on than like looking around and trying to stick the thing in the thing and taking out your inventory and taking the items in your inventory and putting them on the other items. This game does have a function where you can hit, I don't remember what button, but it'll bring up everything on the screen you can interact with, right?
That's good. I like when games do that.
Me too, because normally if they have that going for me, it's a point and click adventure. I'm never going to get stuck because I'm just going to put everything on everything until I do the thing. Somehow I still got stuck in this one. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say it's probably just me. But yeah, like, you know, enough comparing this to other games. The sound design of this game rocks. It's got a really creepy, immersive ambiance. There's just a ton of mind-blowing character design, art, and development. And just a really cool environmental world they built here.
And I like on the game page, it says, for completionists, it has alternate endings, developer commentary mode, and hidden secrets on a second playthrough. Ooh.
Ooh, I didn't know about the second playthrough, but I did, like... it's not just a point and click adventure game. You're going to make choices in this game and you're going to end up with you may end up with a crazy different ending than you would have had otherwise if you play the game differently. And I think that's a huge achievement in a point and click adventure game. Normally it's pretty linear. And the only thing that's going to differ is how long it took you to do the thing than your other friend. Things could change for you compared to your friend's playthrough. Things could change from the first playthrough I'm just learning now. And I think that's crazy because I think some of the endings and sort of like routes that it can push you into are also just really matched thematically with what the game is trying to do plot wise. Like, you're not just making choices that have impact, but each of those potential outcomes is just kind of like a chilling and hauntingly good, like in theme thing with the story they're already doing. I'm just really impressed by this, if you can't tell.
Cool. Well, it's $15. What's your verdict?
Buy it.
Okay, I will.
Thank you, Joe. Somebody listens to me.
I try.
Oh my god!
I don't listen to Pernell though.
My shoulder over here.
Pernell talks, and I'm just like, yeah. Speaking of Pernell talking, the next game is What Lies in the Multiverse, developed by Studio Voyager and Iguana Bee, published by Untold Tales. Released March 4th on Xbox One, Switch, and PS4 for $14.99. What Lies in the Multiverse is a story-driven 2D adventure that one could call a dramatic comedy. Filled to the brim with hilarious cartoonish hijinks, the narrative also presents the player with mature and deep themes like death, envy, and obsession. Pernell, what is What Lies in the Multiverse?
It's deep. I don't know. I just thought it was crazy. Wow. Like, they slap that around there a lot. But what it is a quality product. The idea behind this game is that you play as a person that's only referred to as the kid. He is someone who is kind of fascinated with the concept of the multiverse and decide to embark on a mission to write a program to simulate it. And he pulls it off. He does a thing. He hits the enter key and he gets tossed into another dimension, a parallel universe. And he's wandering around. He doesn't know what's going on. Things are flipping back and forth on him. From a nice, quiet utopia with wise monks to a really fucked up environment where everybody's dead and it's not cool.
eventually, while doing this wandering, you know, blind wandering, he comes across a man by the name of Everett, who is pissed because what he did somehow affected the fact that it affected his ability to explore the multiverse, which he was already doing. And now he's got to fix the mistakes that this kid did and get back on track. Funny enough, it doesn't take very long for him to fix this mistake. And then as he's about to leave, the kid asks if he can go along with Everett on his adventure because, quite frankly, he just wants to see more of the multiverse. And Everett wants an assistant to abuse, so he doesn't care. So come along. You're along for the ride. And that's how the game begins. It is really nice. It's one of those games where they don't give you a ton that you can do, but what they do give you to do is just enough to propel you along to solve really fun little puzzles and experience the world at large. The stories takes place over a series of chapters, and every chapter, a narrative aside, has the same general flow. You end up in a place. The place needs to be explored, either because of a story MacGuffin to find or just to get to the end of a location or whatever. And you are tasked as the kid with exploring it. Now, the only thing you can do at base value is walk, jump, and push objects. And that's pretty much it. Also, you can sometimes pick things up. But the twist and the thing that adds a little bit of the game for the puzzle platforming is that Everett, on certain areas of the game, most of the game anyway, Everett lends you his ability to change dimensions. So at the press of a trigger button, you'll go from one parallel universe to the next. Unfortunately, I will just get this out of the way. I was kind of saddened by this. I was hoping as at the course of the game, you'd eventually be to jump to like five parallel universes at once and trying to juggle the different interfaces. Though I guess I could also see that being something that could get confusing for a number of players if they did that.
So that they sounds like it'd be complex as fuck trying to program too.
It absolutely would. Yeah. Having to balance all out and get all the intricacies just right. Yeah. So I can understand that. But
Pernell, you're just always demanding more out of these poor developers. Isle of Jura needs mining, god damn it.
I keep thinking about that.
But I do like the game anyway, so even what they did, I like what they gave us. It's usually two environments, and it's always like exactly what the environments entail. It's usually like a happy place
and a not so happy place.
And the things are just usually things that are slightly different, but different enough that you can use the differences in the environments to progress. So let's say, for example, one area is a cave, and the cave currently just seems like you're at an impasse, the end of a corridor. If you go to the other environment, there is maybe a hole in the ceiling, but you can't quite reach the hole in the ceiling because there's no way to get up there. But the other side did have a box, so you can push the box within range of the hole in the vine on the other side, jump off the box in one universe, and while you're in the air, switch to the other universe to grab the vine and pull yourself up out of the hole. So you'll be doing a lot of things like that. And there's some cases where it'll be an object. I can't remember the name of it. It's like an incongruable or something. It's basically an object that is glitching out and is existing in multiple universes at the exact same time. And when you come across those, that's an object that, will exist in both sides. And it adds a little bit of a puzzle element to it that I don't want to say because it kind of spoils how it works. But that will change a little bit of how you interact with the objects, too, compared to other times. There's also a few other things that you will do every once in a while, like scenarios where you're locked into a dimensional shift and you can't change it, whatever. But better just to find them on your own anyway, because again, it's kind of cool when they finally do throw like some puzzly curveballs at you. But it doesn't really matter anyway, because I just enjoyed looking around to try to figure out the way out of each individual puzzle room. I like the idea of the ability to try to find the occasional collectible objects that will exist on the environments, and they're not just collectibles. Whoa, cat!
Now that's a soundbite I want.
I hope the mic got it well.
Oh,
that sounded good, dude.
So the objects actually provide a little bit of a narrative element to the game, and I'll spoil one of them because it gives an impact of like how dark the game can get, as they were saying it. So there's one part early on in the game, which is actually what kind of got me into the shock value of the game anyway. There's a part where you're kind of like in the woods, You're walking around, and you climb up on this rock, and you go to the next screen, and there's a dad and this little girl, you know, hanging out by a tent and just having a little picnic. We have a good time. The girl's like, I'm glad I get to spend time with my daddy. He's always stuck at work, and we got the day off. And dad's like, I just love spending time with my kid. It's one of the best things in this life that I have to offer, whatever. You go to the other universe.
I'm laughing so hard through all that, by the way. That was so
well, maintain that feeling of upliftingness, because if you switch to the other world, the little girl is dead and the father is down on the other side of the room. And there is a journal sitting next to the dad. The journal determines that something occurred. I don't know what it is, but something occurred that left them stranded in the woods. And they couldn't get help. No one showed up. So the dad inevitably ate the kid and then died of starvation anyway.
Nice.
It's fucked up. Yeah. So I was like, wow, it's been going. I've been having a great time exploring the multiverse. And holy shit, that actually happened. That's pretty sad. But the thing about it, which is at least kind of nice to know, is that this is a multiverse and anything and everything happens at any given point in time, which means in some universe, I've been cannibalized right now. But thankfully, I don't live in that one, so I'm okay. And in another universe, that little girl is okay, too. So it's okay. Just don't go back to that one. But yeah, you'll come across a number of scenarios like that. And it's actually kind of cool to see, you know, one thing happen, go to the other place and see how that played. Like, how the hell what is going on? And of course, you'll come across the object sometimes that explains it. And it just adds a little bit of extra spice to the adventure, you know? And aside from that, though, there's actually a full-blown narrative going on where there's like a whole group of people that are actually trying to track down Everett because of him. I don't want to spoil any of that either, but basically he has something of theirs. He's doing something they don't like, and they're trying to put a stop to it. So they're basically stalking you through the multiverse traveling that you're doing while you're trying to go on your mission as well. So, and their interactions are actually very nice. Like, they're genuine, well-written dialogue exchanges.
Speaking of well-written, I got to take one of the sentences in the store's page for it, because I appreciate the wording in this. Things inevitably go batshit crazy very fast in the multiverse when you discover the ability to travel between parallel worlds. They actually said batshit crazy in the game description. That gets bonus points to me.
They aren't mincing words. They want you to know that that guy's going to eat his kid. They want you to know it. But this is a really nice game. Like, I've enjoyed every story bit. I like going to different worlds, and I like talking to the different residents, even though I know that the residents generally don't give me anything. It's like a working designs game where you would talk to people that you know have nothing to provide you for your quests, but you just want to hear what they have to say, you know? It just feels nice to talk to everybody you see. And anytime you see a person, like, I got to talk to that guy. And if you can't talk to them because of a dialogue, they ain't put dialogue in for them, you kind of frown a little inside. Cause like, I was looking for something cool to be heard, you know? It's a good game. I'm not going to say it's a wholesome game, but there's niceness in it too. It's funny.
It's an well-written, M-rated wholesome game for the kids.
Yeah, well, honestly, let's be real here. I watched Nightmare on Elm Street when I was like 5, so...
You're not supposed to.
I know, but I'm a special child. Look, unique. Yeah. I'm a unique child. Unique. There we go.
Favorite use of unique on the show.
You and I see what... Let me stop.
No, 15 bucks on game. Multiverse. What do you think?
Snatch It Up is worth your time and money, and you will be thoroughly entertained throughout your adventure.
Cool beans. All right, one final game to discuss tonight. We're taking one more look at 30XX, developed and published by Battery Staple Games, originally released February 2021 on Steam Early Access for $19.99. Newest update hit February 28th, and Chris, that's what you're going to talk to us about. So what is going on in the newest update for 30XX?
All right, 30XX 0.33XX. No, for real. It actually is the 0.33 patch.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, I kind of like that. So it's like 30XDXXX033. I don't know. Anyways. yeah, so we got a couple of new things in this game that I reviewed last week and didn't realize there was new stuff that I had access to because I'm a professional. So, yeah. So briefly, you know, 30XDX, as we talked about, is basically a Mega Man-like, Mega Man X specifically-like game that is roguelike with stages that are basically, let's call them stage templates, because when you actually access the stage, they're randomized out of, you know, certain things. But there's a Mega Mode, you know, very cleverly named, that allows you to fix, like, that randomness into one static you know, configuration so that you can work on the stage as you get murdered by Floppy Fish and have to start all over again. So, speaking of Floppy Fish, the main thing about the new update is that they have added an eighth level, which, of course, as you know, is the Mega Man minimum.
What pancakes?
Stages, right? And but up to this point, I suppose they've had seven. So the eighth level theme, quote unquote, like the collection of assets that make up this eighth level, is called Watergrave or Watergrav. I actually think Watergrav. Yeah. We're gonna call it Watergrav. It actually combines two ideas that have been used in the Mega Man universe before, but are put together in a very not everyday way in this game.
Unique.
Yeah, I know. I don't even know what the opposite of unique is. I mean, common, of course, but anyways. So yeah, it's hard to get away from that terminology.
It is.
So
that's,
what
that's our
brings,
life now.
Yeah, exactly. Our good pastor life. So anyways, what this level brings to the table is stuff that you may recognize if you're an old head with the Mega Man series like myself. You'll see that this stage is a water level, essentially. It has watery bits. It has watery enemies. One of those watery enemies is a fish that, when it's in the water, is a is a force to be reckoned with. It's going to chase after you and like try to bite you and stuff. But if there is no water and there is still an enemy there, they're going to flop around on the land and they can still do damage. But they're just little floppy robot fish. It's adorable. But here's where that kind of enters into like play is that. Not only are there, well, it's like kind of goo, right? It's not like exactly water, because it can also be suspended from the ceiling, which is leads me to the next thing. It's basically going to take the gimmick from Gravity Man stage from Mega Man 5, aka the best one, and where you can basically trigger a certain like panel of lights with, you know, arrows going either up or down to switch the gravity of not only the stage but of your character. So now you're, you know, Lionel Richie, you know, walking on the ceiling, and you know, with the controls reversed as well. So like that adds a whole new element to like the platforming and such. Which again, if you've played like Metal Storm on the NES or Mega Man 5, two of my favorite games ever, then yeah, you'll be right at home with this gimmick. So yeah, like it basically kind of introduces both of those elements. And like I said, when you switch the gravity, sometimes the water switches as well. So then enemies that were flopping around on the ground, suddenly they're in the water and now they're able to actually attack you and stuff. And so it's like, it's actually pretty clever. Again, though, it's still arranged in like kind of a random way, but it still makes for some like really interesting scenarios. And then, of course, the boss at the end of this stage is, what are they called? I can't find it. Anyway. So there's this new a new boss that's basically kind of a Beast Man from Mega Man 7, but like also utilizing the gravity thing, and it does the thing where it kind of it like shows you like targets of where it's targeting, and then that kind of gives you the opportunity to dodge its room full of lasers that it then sends after you, or explosions. Very challenging. And the kind of unfortunate thing about this is that once I unlocked that content, I realized that you have to start a new game in Mega Man or in Mega Mode. You can't just apply it to your old save. So all of my stuff I had collected up to that point was now not there. So I had to kind of go in with like the base stuff, but that's okay. So that's the new level. It's very exciting, and kudos for them to, you know, kind of bringing in some of my favorite mega gimmicks from, you know, years past, and, you know, also keeping it fresh, which is really cool. I actually quite like this level. And Then the other thing is basically that they've introduced some new cores and an armor set. So they now have this armor set that is, I think, in four pieces that are scattered in, you know, in the levels, and you like basically have to go through an enemy gauntlet to get them. But once you get them all together, then it basically changes your character sprite and gives you some new cool things that you can do. They have a nice little preview video on YouTube kind of showing off some of those like cool effects. Very reminiscent of Mega Man X3 with collecting, you know, the armor upgrades and then getting the gold upgrade after that, you know. But, you know, like basically like in the X series, it's collecting, you know, those things. And then there's a couple of different cores. The Vagrant set, which is some augmentations that basically introduce corruption, which is a little bit like the glass cannon kind of thing. It's basically it makes you more powerful. And this is their quote, but pushing it too far will cause damage and a brief stun. So, you know, they've kind of got, it's kind of just another different way to play it, like kind of going high powered, but don't overheat yourself kind of deal. And then there is the Zookeeper set, which is really interesting to me, although I haven't had a chance to like mess with it yet. So the Zookeeper set allows you to collect a whole bunch of repros, which are basically like, in a Castlevania game or whatever, it's like your familiars. It's like they follow you around and like do stuff when you do stuff. And the Zookeeper set like allows you to have a whole bunch of them. And then you basically amass this little army of adorable robots with which to destroy anything and everything, including all of the floppy fish. And past that, yeah, they just reworked a couple of things. They've kind of added a two-layer charge shot, so it's no longer 1 second to charge your charge your lasers. Now it's like half a second for half a charge, and then 1.5 seconds for a full charge. So that's kind of really cool. And then, you know, after that, it's just some tweaks and stuff, but it's mostly these armor sets and the new level, and they're all really good.
Nice. So is it a worthwhile update?
Yeah, I'd absolutely say so. It really, yeah, it feels like the game's more like complete now, because like I said, you know, having 7 stages instead of 8 felt a little weird. Yeah. But yeah, no, this is a really good quality stage. And I mean, the gameplay was really good up to this point too. So it wasn't like it felt like a incomplete game. It's just like now it's like, okay, now we're talking.
Yeah. And best of all, the price did not go up. So it is still $19.99. Yeah. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm still going to give this one a buy it. I think it's a great, you know, like I said last time, it's a great fresh take on like the beloved action platformer series, but it's it doesn't feel too derivative because, again, it adds in a random element, which may or may not please you because, you know, obviously, like I said, the star of a Mega Man game is the level design. But that's okay because I feel like they've brought in enough things, especially with like the cores and the armors and like, you know, different items and upgrades that you can just have, you know. I felt like they've done enough of that to where it does really make this game kind of stand out and kind of justifies that randomness. So yeah, I'm just this one has a buy it. I'd say for sure. Yeah, go wishlist this one and buy it when you can.
Cool beans. All right, that is it for this episode. Made it through.
Woo. Nice. And we're early, so now I can ask Purnell questions about Elden Ring.
That is true.
Go ahead. What more do you want to talk about?
Okay, man. So here's what happened to me. My dude and I start playing. He gets in the camp we're talking about with the soldiers, and he kills the dude, the hardest dude, with the feather hat. You know who I'm talking about? He's got the helmet with the giant feather
hat.
Yeah,
the guy's walking down the middle of the hall.
Yeah. I like how Chris is like, yeah, yeah. So he kills that guy. First time he kills him, he gets the helmet. So one of the reasons I was farming those guys is because I really wanted the helmet, man. But like, I've killed that guy probably 35 times now, and I don't have any drop from him. What's up with the drops in this game? Is that really like, are they like really rare? Or is it just because I'm at a lower level?
I think it's just an RNG thing, because funny you say that, because I did that camp, did whatever I expected to do and was happy with what I pulled out. But on one of my moments of weakness, I looked at the wiki to see if there was anything special about that zone that I just missed. And an item they mentioned was a partisan. I was like, a partisan? Where the hell is a partisan in? I looked everywhere.
What is a partisan?
It's a type of spear.
I want a spear so bad. I haven't seen one.
Apparently, it drops from your feathered hat friend, and I didn't get it. So I was like, you know, I ain't going back for that shit. Whatever. I'm done. And the thing about it in the end is that, you know, the items will drop sometimes, and there's no harm in trying to get them if you know an enemy's going to drop something and you might want it. But
in my instance, at least, I mean, it doesn't hurt that I'm playing as a sorcerer, so I wouldn't have had as much use of a spear as I would have with one of my characters from the older games. But I eventually decided, you know, after killing them two or three times on, like, entering other people's games and stuff, I just didn't feel like it was worth it. I was like, yeah, I'll move on. I'll find something better later. But would I be saying that if he dropped a really cool sorcery stack? Probably not, because I really want a new staff. I'm using the same fucking staff I started the game with. Despite moving quite a ways into the map for my
all you got to do is explore more per now and you'll find something
better. Get out there, buddy.
You just say that like it's a bad thing.
Just keep exploring, you'll find something good. No grinding, you can't grind enemies.
You do realize that that is exactly how I'm supposed to find it. I just haven't found the fucking thing that gives me the staff yet.
Pernell's being his own straight man right now. I'm loving this.
I haven't found the exact place I'm supposed to explore. That's the problem.
You're an astrologer, right?
Yeah, I chose the astrologer set.
I haven't, now that I'm thinking of it, I haven't seen like one magic item. Like, I'll see stuff that doesn't really apply to me. Like, I don't need these heavy greaves because I'm sneaking around trying to stab people in the back because I'm scared of everybody. But like, I haven't seen one staff or like anything.
Yeah, it's crazy. I'm like, how is it like I haven't seen a single thing? I eventually did find someone who sells incantations, but no. Freaking sorcery, staffs, spells, nothing. I'm using the same two fucking spells is driving me crazy. I'm just thankful that the spells themselves are still useful, but I want to actually get some more whoppers. I want to start wrecking heads with some cool shit, because in this game, unless you have a distraction, it actually ends up being pretty rough to get spells off when enemies are like speeding and rushing your face all the damn time. Like, there's an enemy you're going to see almost as soon as you're done round grinding that camp, that when he first came down, I was like, oh shit. But I was like, wait a minute, I'm a sorcerer now. I'm not a melee guy. So I just started spamming him. Like, spam bullet.
I know
spam
you're
talking.
When you say came down, do you mean that troll that jumps down?
Yeah, that's the guy.
That guy jumped down, scared the shit out of me so bad. That's why I turned around. I started grinding this guy. I was like, I need to give him a shot, though. Like, I know he's like on the main trail to like advance. I know I need to be able to kill. I got spooked late Saturday night, man. I was too scared.
And you know how to summon people already, right?
Yeah, I can do like the dogs. And I think I just got this jellyfish.
No. I'm not talking about the animal summons. I mean, like
multiplayer.
Humans.
Yeah, I kept telling myself, I mean, after talking to you today, I'm probably going to see this game a little differently. But I've been kind of like, you know, I feel like I need to get better at it. And then I didn't want my friends to see me. Like, I don't want to like kill you. Yeah, I've got anxiety about seeing me.
Here's how you grind. Like, here's a good way to grind. Joe, here's a good way to grind. So
you're not supposed to grind, though.
Well, the way, listen to me, Joe, the way you actually grind.
This show's never going to end.
That's fine, because this is a good topic, and everyone's learning something today.
You better cut the recording now. I can't keep recording.
Actually, you should cut the recording while I'm trailing off on some Elden Ring gibberish.
Hey, speaking of, that reminds me, I know what I'm going to call this episode.
What?
The Elden Bling?
Pern Elden Ring.
Ooh. Oh my god, that's so good!